The following Dharma talk was given by Danika Shoang Ankele Osho at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan Osho is a Dharma holder and priest in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered freely. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everybody. Good afternoon, everyone who's joining One Continuous Thread. This is from the Platform Sutra, which is a Chinese text that is one of the earliest kind of specific Chan or Zen teachings, where the distinguishing features of the Zen school were being articulated in teaching that originated. The earliest version is from around the year 780, so a couple hundred years or so after the supposed beginning, dawn of Zen. So very early, and then there are additional versions and iterations that span the next several centuries up to the 13th century. So this is from the first section of the Platform Sutra. Some of you are familiar with it and know this, is a retelling of the story of Hui Neng, his kind of spiritual biography. And then the second chapter of the sutra then is him offering his teaching. And so this is from the second chapter. This is the launch, okay? This is the launch of Zen. All right. He begins. And it's called the Platform Sutra because he's on a teaching platform used to offer the precepts. He begins, "Everyone, clear your minds and mentally invoke Maha Prajna Paramita." He goes on to say, "This is the great insight of having arrived at the other shore." A little further in, "What does Maha mean? Maha means great. The extent of mind is vast as space, without bounds. It has no squareness or roundness, no largeness or smallness. It has no blueness, yellowness, redness, or whiteness. It has no up or down, no long or short. It has not anger and no joy, no right and no wrong, no good and no bad. It has no head and no tail. The land of all Buddhas are all the same as space. The subtle nature of people in the world is originally empty, with nothing that can be grasped. The true emptiness of our inherent nature is also like this. Good friends, the extent of mind is so vast, it pervades the cosmos." This invocation of Maha Prajna Paramita, which we invoke, right, many times in a single day of Sesshin. And we invoke it both by uttering those words. In the same section of the sutra, Wei Neng speaks about how to really bring this teaching alive in the mind isn't a matter of just saying the words, which of course we know, and sometimes that's frustrating because it's a lot easier to say the words than it is to touch the reality with our being. But we're here to transform our experience of life. And so we have to be willing to do the hard part. I was reflecting on like this vast, boundless, great mind pervading the cosmos, and just how often our liturgy, which liturgy is, you know, it's teachings. Liturgy is teachings sort of sprinkled throughout the day. So even from the very beginning of our you know, first chanting that we do together in the day, when we chant the four immeasurables, may all beings be free from suffering. All beings. That's our invocation to start the day. There's no parameter. It's not just, you know, the practitioners in this hall or the people that I know and love, or even human beings. May all beings. We're moving from that into vast is the robe of liberation, a formless field of benefaction. So again, vast, formless, no boundaries, no edges. The Heart Sutra, I mean, that's going in, you know, with taking us, sort of leading us in a little more and more deeply into what is this vast, boundless mind. What is Maha Prajna Paramita? Mostly by saying it's not this, it's not that. I was thinking too about Gokhan's talk the other day on the Avatamsaka Sutra, the purifying practices chapter, right? And that dialogue with Manjushri, where like the questioner asks, the Bodhisattva asks Manjushri about how to purify our body, speech, and mind. And Manjushri responds by basically saying, with each activity that you do, bring all beings to mind, right? Bathing the body, may all living beings be clean in body and mind, pure and shining within and without. Each activity, he went through a few of them. Putting on a belt, who knew? Everything's an opportunity to open, expand. We eat to stop all evil, to practice good, to save all sentient beings. So our experience of suffering is characterized, you might say, energetically by a bounded, constricted sense of our being. Dio offered some encouraging words earlier about finding, like discovering, are those edges really there? If we're feeling pressed up against, can we like actually practice and find where things open? How do we encounter the vastness? How do we bring it alive? Isn't it interesting that we bring it alive by going into one thing completely? Like, what a paradox. What a paradox. When we sweep the floor, whole body and mind, suddenly the universe opens. So that containing quality of Sesshin is actually the way that we come through and feel no edges. So interesting. And one of the things that we really get to know in Zazen is how the small sense of ourself is pretty much entirely driven by thought and story. So when we're given a practice like being intimate with our breath or intimate with a koan, we have to trust to go completely into that practice. That's where we're going to meet this mind that pervades the cosmos. And yet our habit is so deep and strong to hang out there in the bounded self. There's a way in which this bringing to mind all the beings, right? If we can appreciate that that's part of a strong piece of liturgy and teaching, is like all sentient beings, all sentient beings, all sentient beings, dedicating the merit to all sentient beings. I mean, we can be mouthing the words and really just concerned about this sentient being. But the teaching is like, no, open, 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 open. You're not separate. You're not separate. You're not separate. And so we're invited, to quote Reb Anderson, to recognize that we are in relationship with everyone. To see that we are not separate. To attune, in a sense, within our being, not as an idea, to attune to this vast body. To say we're in relationship is just a stepping stone. Because when there's one thing, how is there a relationship? It's just one thing. And yet, to practice, we do need to attune to relationship, because our experience is relational. It's happening in the relational sphere, right? We talk about the two truths, the absolute one mind pervading the cosmos and the relative, me and you, serving the oatmeal, cleaning the bowl. Things are happening here in the relational world, for sure. And so the epitome of this relationship and how it works, the mind that pervades the cosmos and like, here I am, I don't feel like I'm pervading the cosmos. This is the two arrows meeting in midair. Right? We can see for ourselves, what is that teaching pointing to? The box and its lid. The absolute and the relative meeting perfectly. What does that look like? It looks like this. I wanted to take up this like aspect of practice of attuning our relationship by bringing in the teachings of Joanna Macy, who Hojin invoked at the start of the week kind of dedicated our session to, in a sense. And for those who may not be familiar with her, she was a climate activist and an author. Really, an organizer of a movement in taking spirituality and deep wisdom and systems theory and deep ecology and psychology and understanding who we are and kind of saying like, here's how we can meet this moment that we're in, where our world is in peril. She wrote many books. She taught different places. There's an institute at Naropa that bears her name. And her work and her insight, she started early. She's like a total like thought leader. She's like way out ahead of the kind of environmental activism that we encounter now, where I think there's a broader recognition of sort of the need to reckon with and feel the grief at what we see as we look out into the world, and to let that mobilize us. That wasn't how things started. That's people's evolution and understanding that we're inheriting. And Joanna Macy was a key person in that. She writes about her experience in the 70s as a anti-nuclear activist, of feeling the peril of the planet and feeling so gripped by grief and anxiety, and bringing that into therapy and basically being told that, like, it was a matter of her libido, and like the bulldozers were like a symbol of something, you know, use your imagination. And she didn't trust that. She thought, no, what I'm experiencing is real and true. And she started to explore further and then share what she was learning with others, and led workshops and retreats throughout the 80s and 90s and beyond, really. I mean, her obituary in the New York Times said that she retired last year, so that would have been retiring at age 95. So really, really tireless. And the Buddhist teachings are completely integrated into her offering. So she wrote a book that she's extremely well known for. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with it. Came out in 1991, called World as Lover, World as Self. And I wanted to use that as a little bit of a way of understanding Zen practice. In the opening chapter of that book, she talks about how critical our view is as a human being finding ourselves in the world. How do we understand where we are? And of course, this has such resonance with Dharma teachings, where right view is offered as kind of the first aspect of the Noble Eightfold Path. Another nod to Gokhan. Thank you for that. So she offers up a few different ways that we might identify our view of the world. And the first is the world as a battleground. So this is the view of the world as the stage where, like, the battle of good and evil, the struggle for power and primacy, is taking place. And interestingly, she also talks about a very different frame with a similar energy, which is the world as classroom. And again, the world here is a stage that is, she says, a kind of moral gymnasium, where you are put through certain tests which would prove your mettle and teach you certain lessons so that you can graduate to other arenas and rewards. Okay? So this idea of the battleground or the classroom, she merges. Whether a battlefield or a classroom, the world is a proving ground with little worth other than that. What counts is our immortal souls, which are just being tested here. The second way that we might view the world is as a trap. So this is interesting, and she brings in the spiritual view that often accompanies this, that somehow the world, like, is this kind of like screwed up place where we're like stuck and we have to transcend it. We have to try and like get out of it. That the world is like messy, that somehow our mind is higher than matter. Our spirit is above nature. And so we need to completely like get out of this situation. And interestingly, right, we might feel like a little bit of resonance there, and even some questions about like, well, doesn't that sort of come out in the teachings? We talk about like transcending samsara. Yeah, except that, where's nirvana? It's here. It's here. So there's nothing wrong with the material world in the Buddhist view. There's nothing wrong with your body. And yet we're confused. We're confused. So we have to enlighten our understanding. Then she says, next possible way to view the world is as a lover. Wow. An intimate and gratifying partner. And she brings in teachings from different traditions where there are, you know, myths of how the world came to be and this kind of erotic sort of the beloved, the world as beloved, and the mystic union with the divine happening here in the world. She cites Hildegard of Bingen, I am the breeze which nurtures all things green. Oh, sorry, that's world as self. Okay, so here's what she says about world as lover. She does cite some religious stuff, but then she also talks about how, I'll read this excerpt. A poet friend of mine went through a period of such personal loss that she was catapulted into extreme loneliness. Falling apart into a nervous breakdown, she went to New York City and lived alone. She walked the streets for months until she found her wholeness again. A phrase of hers echoes in my mind. I learned to move in the world as if it were my lover. And then she talks about world as self. And interestingly, these two kind of move back and forth, which I think really is quite resonant from a non-dual perspective. Just as lovers seek union, we are apt, when we fall in love with our world, to fall into oneness with it as well. And so here is Hildegard of Bingen. I am the breeze which nurtures all things green. I am the rain coming from the dew that causes the grasses to laugh with the joy of life. And she goes on to say, the way that we define and delimit the self is arbitrary. We can place it between our ears and have it looking out from our eyes, or we can widen it to include the air we breathe. Or, at other moments, we can cast its boundaries farther to include the oxygen giving trees and plankton, our external lungs, and beyond them, the web of life in which they are sustained. We can kind of work our way through the rational analysis of how she's speaking. And it is powerful to reflect, I think, and see like how many complicated causes and conditions give rise to each moment of our life, and to reflect perhaps somewhat philosophically on like, yeah, where is the boundary? But in Zen, forget the philosophy. Just like I'm sitting here and can feel I, my selfness, as an experience, we can experience that dissolution or broadening ourselves as world. It's a turning of the mind. So this lover, and so, you know, this is the archetypal lover. And I would say, like, this is the lover who you've, like, been with for decades, and, like, the drama has kind of played itself out, right? This is not world as, like, passionate lover who you're, like, in the tangles with trying to sort it. This is, like, long after the infatuation, right? When just being quiet on the porch swing the late summer day is enough. And, you know, I think lover is an evocative word. If it's not relevant to us, like, it's that quality of loving and being loved that's important. So, like, it could be a beagle, you know? I'm thinking of a friend whose beagle, like, that was a love relationship, 100%. Yeah, or a tree, or just a good old friend. That we relate to the world, and by world, I mean this here now. I mean our actual experience, not the idea, but the moment to moment to moment experience that we sort of lump together and call the world. What would it be to relate or practice in such a way? I was remembering a few years back talking about caretaking practice as like this excellent ground for like bringing love alive. And I was saying, I think Genjo was the work supervisor at the time. I was saying, like, wouldn't it be great if we called it like lovemaking practice? And then we'd have like the introductory retreat and we'd be like, okay, it's time for lovemaking practice. We're gonna meet in the dining hall. And you could just hear, like, you know, someone giving instruction and being like, so you're just gonna be like really take making love to that carrot. And each time the mind drifts away, just come back and really make love to that carrot. But it's true. It's true. It's true. So that quality, right? When I was reflecting on like what would that elicit if I took that up as a practice of like world as lover? It's like, okay, it's enough. I'm not looking for something better. This moment, it's enough. To give the moment its full time. Enough with the multitasking or the like other agenda. Making love to that carrot, we like let that take the time it takes. It's not a rush. We allow our attention to sink into the moment. We relish the company. There's a sense of like, I'm committed. I'm not going anywhere. And that means also when it's hard and when we're struggling, it's not a question of get me out of here. We're in it. We're in it. So we may as well pull up a chair, listen, show up, get curious, come closer, not turn away. It's like a being with practice. And then maybe just a being practice. I was thinking of Hojin Sensei in her talk yesterday, how she talked about being still. Not be still, being still. Zazen is like the ultimate being practice. It's like, that's all we're doing. So the thing of it is like when we practice like world as lover, then we're going to see the world differently. In his essay, Take Me to the Water, James Baldwin writes, "Because you love one human being, you see everyone else very differently than you saw them before. Perhaps I only mean to say that you begin to see, and you are both stronger and more vulnerable, both free and bound. Free, paradoxically, because now you have a home, your lover's arms, and bound to that mystery precisely, a bondage which liberates you into something of the glory and suffering of the world." When we learn to love one thing, everything is changed. We have a home. Here, now. World as lover means here, now is your home. Nothing's missing. More vulnerable and stronger, free and bound, liberated into the glory and suffering of the world. And that liberating into the suffering of the world was such a key part of Joanna Macy's teaching. To be open to our own despair, to be open to our own grief. It doesn't matter what we're grieving about. Can we, she says, when we take it in our hands, when we can just be with it and keep breathing, then it turns. It turns to reveal its other face. And the other face of our pain for the world, or is our love for the world. The other face of our pain and our grief is our love and our absolute inseparable connection with all life. And I was thinking about that word lover. Like when we say swimmer or runner or writer or speaker, we mean the one who's doing the swimming, the running, the writing, the speaking. So interestingly, world as lover means the world is loving us. So that carrot is loving us. Can we be open to that possibility? Can we like allow enough space in that vast and boundless mind to feel how that carrot is loving us? In a conversation on the On Being podcast, Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams was speaking about love. Krista Tippett asked her about the role of love in social movements. And her connection to bell hooks' work on love. Let me see if I can go right. Okay, so she says, this is Reverend Angel. She said, "Reading Bell and getting an opportunity to meet Bell gave me a lens into the possibility of love being something that I could And not only could, I want to say, that I had to bring into the language of my perception of the world. That love was not to be limited to my bedroom or my family and just the people that thought that I liked, which is what we are often doing when our culture calls us to love. Let me just go back. It's a transcript, you know, of a written thing. So it's like you needed to hear her say it. And just people that I thought that I liked. That was what I was doing in the past, and what we often do, and what our culture calls us to do, which is to use love as a quantifier. Like, do I have a preference for you? Am I aligned and in agreement and affinity? Are you reflecting back at me what I want to be reflected back at me? And if you are enhancing my idea of myself, then I love you. She says, Bell opened up the idea that that was a very limited way of understanding, a very limited way of understanding love. And then she says, the way that I think of love most often these days is that love is space. Krista Tippett says, say some more about that. What do you mean? And Reverend Angel says, it's developing our own capacity for spaciousness within ourselves to allow others to be as they are. And I would say, all things to be as they are. That is love. And it doesn't mean that we don't have hopes or wishes that things are changed or shifted, but that to come from a place of love is to be in acceptance of what is, even in the face of moving towards something that is more whole, more just, more spacious for all of us. The way that I think of love most often these days is that love is space. What does Maha mean? Maha means great. The extent of mind is vast as space, without bounds. The lands of all Buddhas are all the same as space. What is this space? What is this love? Beyond the words, in your direct experience, this vast and boundless mind, this world, are they one? Are they two? It's not philosophical. Trust your practice. Know that we don't have to create this love. We don't have to create this space. What a relief. What a relief. It's here. It's already here. Moment to moment practice.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.